Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Jake Johnson of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, who talks about the charges of rampant fraud and militant protests that led to the second cancellation of Haiti's scheduled presidential runoff election. Alex Felsen of the Urban Ecology and Design Lab at Yale University, who describes his work helping states adapt to severe weather events caused by climate change. And David Holtz of the Michigan chapter of the Sierra Club, who examines the causes and solutions to the ongoing water crisis in Flint, Michigan, where many in the city have been exposed to dangerous levels of lead. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In a surge of global inequality, Oxfam reports 62 billionaires have amassed the same wealth as the poorest 3.6 billion people on the planet. The scale of inequality has exploded since 2010, with the wealth of top billionaires rising by $1.76 trillion, while the assets of the bottom half of humanity fell by 41%. Oxfam's report, titled An Economy for the 1%, was released on the eve of the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, an annual gala of the super-rich and well-connected. Mark Goldring, CEO of Oxfam Great Britain, asserted, "World leaders' concerns about the escalating inequality crisis have so far not been translated into concrete action to ensure those at the bottom get their fair share of economic growth." Oxfam also blasted Conservative British Prime Minister David Cameron, who 3 years ago came to Davos to launch an initiative to stop massive tax avoidance by big corporations and the wealthy. Thus far, however, Cameron has done little to push for transparency in tax havens like the Cayman Islands. The Oxfam report estimates wealthy individuals have hidden over $7.6 trillion in overseas accounts. These funds could have generated over $190 billion in taxes to fund public services around the world. 50 Syrian refugees fleeing the brutal civil war in their country received a warm welcome in suburban Clarkston, Georgia, which has emerged as the Ellis Island of the American South in accepting over 60,000 refugees since the 1980s. Inside a community centre, the newly arrived Syrian refugees were greeted with a meal of Middle Eastern food as Mayor Ted Terry praised the role of immigrants in American history. This stands in stark contrast to the views of Georgia's conservative Republican Governor Nathan Deal, who, along with other GOP governors, has sought to halt the flow of Syrian refugees to their states after the ISIS terror attack in Paris. However, the federal government maintains legal jurisdiction over refugee resettlement. Clarkson, a working-class suburb of Atlanta, is among a handful of communities, including Dearborn, Michigan, and Portland, Maine, that have successfully resettled refugees from overseas conflicts. In Clarkson, which opened its doors to refugees in 1983, 4 out of 5 new immigrants have become economically self-sufficient within 6 months of arriving, with many launching new businesses and creating jobs. A RAND Corporation study found 90% of middle school students in the area around Compton, California, had witnessed at least one violent incident. Now, 8 students and teachers are suing the Compton Unified School District for failing to provide adequate resources and training to deal with trauma. New research has found that children and teenagers suffer long-lasting harmful effects after exposure to multiple acts of violence, leading to depression, anxiety, and substance abuse. Annie Hudson Price, an attorney representing the plaintiffs, told the news magazine In These Times, students have a legal right to access resources to deal with trauma and the right to an education. One of our plaintiffs, the attorney said, was kicked out of every school in Compton. They are just being cycled through without getting the help they need. The plaintiffs are pressuring Compton to adopt an alternative approach used in Brockton, Massachusetts. 5 years ago, the working-class community located south of Boston adopted trauma-sensitive reforms in handing out discipline. Educators are urged to act proactively if they know a student was exposed to trauma such as domestic violence. The results, noted Brockton school official Sal Tarasi, are positive, with a decrease in suspensions and an improvement in attendance, resulting in students feeling a sense of belonging. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Nigel Victor Rees.
Under pressure from militant street protests triggered by charges of rampant fraud and a candidate boycott of Haiti's presidential runoff election, the government of unpopular President Michel Martelly canceled the scheduled January 24th vote. This, the second cancellation of the runoff election, comes amid uncertainty about the next steps in a chaotic electoral process. President Martelly's term in office officially ends on February 7th, and negotiations have begun to decide if an interim government would take power after Martelly's exit, or if he would remain in office until a replacement is elected. In the first round of the presidential election on October 25th, Martelly's hand-picked candidate, Jovenel Moïse, a political unknown, won 32.8% of the vote, with opposition candidate Jude Celestin winning 25.3% of ballots cast. Celestin announced he would not participate in the January 24th election due to the overt fraud and manipulation of the vote, a charge echoed by many Haitian and international observers. The second-place candidate said in a statement, quote, "Such utter contempt for the will of the Haitian people must end." Your reporter spoke with Jake Johnson, research associate with the Center for Economic and Policy Research, who talks about the charges of rampant fraud that led to the cancellation of the runoff election and the uncertain future of Haiti's electoral process.
There really had been a growing chorus from all sorts of civil society groups. You had religious leaders, human rights groups, and local observers. And really key among this group towards the end was also private sector groups that generally have been supportive of the president and really sort of had called for a pause to be taken and for this election to be delayed in order for a dialogue and a consensus to be reached in order to move forward. And also key amongst this is the role of the international community, of course. This is a $100 million electoral process, and the international community is funding the bulk of that, including the U.S., the tune of over $30 million. And they were very much pressuring for this election to happen on schedule and on January 24th. And then at the last minute, as these negotiations broke down to try and reach some sort of a deal, sort of pulled the support for that election and started encouraging a dialogue before having the election. And that's really sort of what did in this electoral process on Sunday, and not just sort of the protests, which became the sort of pretext in order to blame the protest for causing this delay, which really was months in the making.
Now, the second place finisher in the previous election, presidential election, Jude Celestin, he declined to participate because of the fraud. What are the declarations being made by Jude Celestin in terms of the reasons why he did not want to participate in this election? And what conditions has he set up, if any, to participate in a future date for a runoff election?
Yeah, well, so key amongst the sort of, actions that have been taken over the last couple of months was an evaluation commission that was actually set up by the president himself. And this is the reason why the presidential election had first been delayed, was in order for this commission to perform its evaluation. And they did come back with a pretty, scathing report of the irregularities. In fact, they found only 8% of the tally sheets they looked at were totally free from any sort of irregularities. And that, in a number of cases, there were significant irregularities, and that a number of people had been voting, these political party monitors, able to vote off list, and that this made up a significant chunk of the voters. They outlined a number of steps to be taken to move forward, amongst them replacing the Electoral Council that had sort of been discredited throughout this process for its handling of the situation. It also called for sort of taking a further look at certain aspects of what had happened. Also, especially, as they pointed out, was retraining and rehiring all of the poll workers that were complicit in these irregularities or that were responsible for some of these actions that were carried out. And what happened was directly after that report was issued, just a few days later, Martelly, by decree, invoked this election for the 24th, so without time to really implement or see how those changes could play out. And the implementation of those recommendations has sort of been the center point of what Celestin has been asking for, and as well as many of the human rights groups and the business chambers as well have been asking for these recommendations to be implemented.
Jake, there have been demands for Martelly's removal from office, and I wondered if you would talk about the possible way forward should he leave the presidency or is succeeded by a provisional government when his term expires on February 7th.
Yes, that sort of remains the main sticking point in the negotiations currently for what happens next. There had been days of sort of negotiations about what this would look like. And then when it came down to it on Friday, things were really, this is again 48 hours before the election was set to begin. It was still all set, apparently. And finally, when the Electoral Council called for the cancellation of the election. There was no date set sort of as part of a political agreement. And so, you know, the situation now is sort of back to the drawing books. And as all sides sort of approach the table and find a way forward. And I think that the question now is who is at that table and who's trying to sort of make that decision. Marta Lee has sort of indicated that he would like to be there to hand over, you know, the presidential sash to his successor. Obviously sort of emboldened by the cancellation of the election, some of the protesting groups are also calling for Marta Lee's immediate removal before the end of his term, which is February 7th. I think the most likely situation would be some sort of deal where Marta Lee leaves office at the end of his term on February 7th and as a consensus government is formed. And I think the question now is sort of what the makeup of that government might look like.
Jake, I wanted to get your view on why the Obama administration had supported going forward with elections until the 11th hour, elections where there would only really, in essence, be one candidate. And despite the widely held view from people on the ground there in Haiti and international human rights groups that the first round of balloting was rife with fraud, why would the Obama administration want to go forward here?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent question. And I think, you know, a lot of the political support behind Marta Lee for pushing this right till the edge and letting these tensions build over the previous months has been that support from the international community. I think when you look at it, there's a number of interests there. One is obviously as the funders of this election, they have, you know, a lot of interest in seeing it happen in an orderly manner. There also has been, you know, obviously billions of dollars invested in this country by the international community after the earthquake and really dating back to the 2004 coup after which the UN troops have been in Haiti. And so there's been a tremendous amount of money spent on trying to build up Haiti's institutions by the international community. And to see this process forward was supposed to be sort of a culmination of this action. And this dates back also to the 2010 election where Marta Lee came to power, in which there was also many problems in the election. And it wasn't until actually Marta Lee's supporters took to the streets and the international community intervened that he was able to make it to the runoff and go to the elections. And in fact, the person who he displaced in that round then in 2010 was Jude Celestin, the man participating in the runoff this time. So I think you have to really go back and see these relationships develop and the roles of all the players to understand where the interest lies, certainly with the international community in the current process.
That was Jake Johnson, research associate with the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Learn more about Haiti's troubled electoral history and political instability by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. As much of the East Coast was digging out from the historic snowstorm and coastal flooding that hit the region in late January, the federal government announced that it had awarded $1 billion to 14 states through the Department of Housing and Urban Development's National Disaster Resilience Competition. Connecticut, where 95% of the population lives within 50 miles of the coast and has suffered massive damage to its coastline in several recent storms, received roughly $54 million. Those funds will be spent developing a project in Bridgeport based on the state's resilience corridor concept, developing a regional planning effort for 13 municipalities in Fairfield and New Haven counties. The federal grant will also finance the development of a climate change adaptation framework through the Connecticut Institute for Resilience and Climate Adaptation at the University of Connecticut. Alex Felsen, a registered landscape architect for the past 15 years, worked closely with the University of Connecticut and state agencies on the HUD grant application. Through his own firm and the Urban Ecology and Design Lab at Yale, which he runs, he's focused on coastal adaptation, green infrastructure, and constructed ecosystems. He earlier won a $10 million grant to construct bioretention gardens at Seaside Village, a residential complex in coastal Bridgeport, Connecticut. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Felsen, who describes how his work is helping the region adapt to severe weather events caused by climate change.
When you look at the risks that the state faces across these coastal areas, you know, there's some tremendous risks for Connecticut. It's second to Florida in terms of the amount of investment along the coast that's insured property. There's a lot of concern, especially with the Metro North and Highway 95 running parallel to the coast, with the functionality of the transportation infrastructure under future storm events and sea level rise. So what we developed was what we called a resilience corridor, which builds on transit-oriented development as a concept. So it's really an economic development proposal to connect resources and access upland to the shorefront communities or to the shorefront conditions. So rather than investing in repetitive flood loss housing along the shorefront or investing in directly in these neighborhoods, we're investing in the connecting corridors to these neighborhoods and looking at ways of using coastal adaptation funding as a tool to promote economic development, building on Metro North as a kind of connector across Connecticut.
Alex Felsen, are people in your field talking about moving people and infrastructure like railroad lines away from the immediate coast and abandoning it? I know after Superstorm Sandy, Governor Cuomo talked about buying up coastal properties and letting them go back to nature as a way of providing a storm buffer. Is that something that's going to be necessary in Connecticut or other regions? What's Connecticut Governor Daniel Malloy's take on this?
The governor talks about building up, not back. Connecticut has a unique condition in contrast to New Jersey or Florida or other locations. Florida and New Jersey, these are coastal plains, coastal Piedmonts, so they're fairly flat topographically. Connecticut is, because of the glacial landscape and the historic geology, was the basis of how the state formed over time. It creates these kind of ridge lines that run north-south and that have more of a patchy network of low-lying areas along the coast. And so the risks along the coasts are smaller patches. With some strategic reorganization and restructuring, as well as some effective kind of economic revitalization strategies in these corridors that create egress from areas at risk, the idea is to really reframe and value the land that we have and the housing stock that we have along the coast effectively for future conditions and to become, coastally adapted for the future. So it's pretty distinct from New Jersey or Florida and elsewhere in terms of the adaptation strategy that we're proposing. We're not really looking at retreat as an agenda. We're looking at economic revitalization as a tool to structure relationships between the upland resources and upland connections and down to the shorefront communities.
Is there anything else you or people in your field are working on regarding coastal resilience?
There's all kinds of opportunities for rethinking or for establishing strategic phasing for how to adapt to future conditions. The challenge is that there's been a lot of build-out, a lot of infrastructure development and critical facilities built in coastal areas. And with homeowners and property ownership and private property, it creates a conundrum at the local scale for how to navigate and negotiate land use changes. That's where I think the value of, landscape architecture and planning fields come in, where it's not just an infrastructure solution, but it's really an issue of communicating across the stakeholders and establishing solutions that are co-generated at a local level that can promote or allow for adaptation over time, but that can also use the funding towards ecological benefits and social benefits. So in Connecticut, the idea of the resilience corridor, while it functions as an egress to help alleviate some of the risk within each municipality, it also allows for access to the coast, which is one of the issues that we have in Connecticut, is that we have limited access to the coast. So it strategically adds a social value while also creating risk reduction. And I think that idea of multifunctional landscapes and developing these ecologically rich and socially rich solutions are the way to move this forward.
That was Alex Felsen, a landscape architect, assistant professor at Yale University, and head of Yale's Urban Ecology Design Lab. For more information on Felsen's work and climate change adaptation, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The water crisis in Flint, Michigan, has in recent weeks attracted widespread media attention, with a focus on the reckless actions of Michigan Republican Governor Rick Snyder's administration. The governor's appointment of an emergency manager in Flint, nullifying the city's democratic governance, began a chain of events that led to the municipality switching water sources from Detroit's public water system to the Flint River in April 2014. The water from the river corroded the city's pipes and contaminated the water supply with dangerous levels of lead, impacting Flint's mostly poor and black population of 100,000. Lead poisoning can produce lifelong health effects, especially in children. That includes brain damage, learning disabilities, and behavioral problems. Although Governor Snyder recently apologized for his administration's mistakes that resulted in Flint's water disaster, his attorney general's appointment of a special counsel to determine if state laws were broken was later revealed to be a donor to both the governor and attorney general's 2010 and 2014 election campaigns, which did not instill confidence in the credibility of the investigation. Local and state government were not alone in their culpability in Flint's water crisis. Susan Hedman, administrator for the Environmental Protection Agency region responsible for Michigan, has resigned effective February 1st due to charges that she hadn't done enough to prevent the lead contamination of Flint's water. Your reporter spoke with David Holtz, executive committee chair of the Michigan chapter of the Sierra Club, who examines the causes and solutions to the ongoing water crisis in Flint, as well as the role of environmental racism in the disaster.
People almost immediately after the switch to the Flint River noticed that there was something wrong with their water. They weren't scientists, but it tasted funny. It looked funny. It was brown, discolored. And then after they would take these complaints to, like you would expect in any community, to their local public officials. But unlike in any other community, the local public officials had no power to do anything about it. So it was this sort of echo chamber of people complaining. The state, through their public relations people at the state agency in charge of drinking water, dismissed them as kind of being troublemakers and really downplayed the whole thing. And meanwhile, within the government process, we had this very interesting and tragic tension going on where drinking water experts inside the state government, who were the regulators, were not treating the water according to law, the legal requirements. They were testing and monitoring outside the protocols that are required under the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act. And all of this sort of came to the attention of a few people just about kind of at the same time. One was Mark Edwards, who was a drinking water expert from Virginia Tech, and he got basically a call from a woman in Flint and said, I think my water is, there's something wrong with my water. And he took her through the process of testing the water, found lead levels that he said were, in 25 years of his experience as an expert in water, drinking water, he had never seen anything close to the lead levels that were coming out of the faucet in this woman's home. So he immediately began using his own money to recruit people to do testing in Flint. And they came up with a series of samples and using the EPA protocols, and it clearly showed that there was a lead contamination problem. And still inside the state agency, drinking water agency, they were discounting, downplaying, dismissing, and reassuring people publicly that nothing was wrong with their water.
David, tell us what role you think environmental racism may have played in the various missteps that were made here by local and state government.
I cannot imagine that if a community, say Grosse Pointe, which is a wealthy suburban Detroit community, or Bloomfield Hills, which is in one of the wealthier counties in America, in Michigan, if there was lead contamination, or if they were switching their water source and needed corrosion controls, that someone in state government would have said, for instance, well, we're going to save $150 a day by not treating the water, so let's not treat the water. You know, it's really unimaginable that would have happened in a white, wealthy community in America. And, you know, communities like Flint, and there are other, you know, there is a pattern in practice in Michigan in the last, say, 6, 7, 8 years where whenever there is a choice between protecting public health, whether it's water or air, or saving money or delivering a benefit for a wealthy corporation, the choice seems often, if not always, to err on the side of, not protecting the public when it comes to community of color.
David, as we conclude here, what are the steps you think it will take to have a resolution, a safe resolution to the water crisis in Flint? How much money is going to be needed? How much reconstruction of the infrastructure in Flint has to be done?
You know, the best answer to that question really is that the EPA has issued an emergency order where it's beginning to assume control over the Flint water monitoring and is attempting to hold the state to the requirements of the law. And the requirements of the law are pretty, you know, the lead and copper rule has very specific rules about what you do in situations like that. And the rules, first of all, require a level of monitoring that hasn't gone on so you know the scope of the problem. When you understand that the problem has triggered more than 10% or more contamination of the drinking water supply and it's related to lead and lead pipes, you have are then required to begin replacing those pipes. That, I think, is sort of the path toward, you know, addressing the situation in Flint. And the costs, the estimates have ranged from $80 million to $1.2 billion to replace the entire lead infrastructure in Flint of water pipes. This is something that, in my view, requires the equivalent of a Marshall Plan for this community, that we need to set aside the ideology that caused this problem and go out and bond to the amount of money that it's going to take to solve the problem and solve the problem and get it moving. This has been the frustration with the Snyder administration in Michigan is that we have not seen the urgency meet the demands of this crisis yet.
That was David Holtz, Executive Committee Chair of the Michigan Chapter of the Sierra Club. For more perspectives on the events leading up to Flint's water crisis, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Nigel Victor Reese, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.